Easter is without question the greatest holiday in the Christmas season. In fact, churches often disagree, but this is one thing all churches agree on, that Jesus came, He lived, He died, and He rose again. And it is a glorious reminder. But it also is a painful reminder, because it reminds us of death. My guess is most of us don't like to think very much about death. I came across an article written by a gentleman by the name of Craig Barnes. It was entitled, Easter in the Era of Terror. Dying, living, dying, and living again after September 11th. And let me just read the beginning of it. He begins his article this way. People flood to churches on Easter because they know they are going to hear good news. But Easter is also terrifying news. According to Mark's gospel, early on Sunday morning, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome made their way to the tomb to anoint the dead body of Jesus. Mark also tells us that these women had earlier watched the crucifixion of Jesus from a distance. When it was all over, they saw Joseph of Arimathea pull the dead body off the cross, wrap it in linen cloth, lay it in a tomb hewn out of rock, and then rolled the stone over the door of the tomb. They watched it all from a distance. That's our favorite perspective on death. We do all we can to keep our distance from it. We try to stay healthy, work out, watch what we eat. We're careful, so careful. It's all a way of keeping death at bay. But occasionally it catches us. Someone we love. And then we know, like these women, that we have to go and see death up close. On September 11th, it became painfully clear that death can always bridge the distance to find any of us. What crumbled on that dark day were not just skyscrapers, but our illusions that we were somehow safe from the violence that the rest of the world has known for a very long time. It doesn't matter how wealthy, well-defended, or far removed we are from evil men, terror can still find us. Every time I drive past the Pentagon and gaze at the gaping wound in its side, I'm reminded that not even powerful generals and admirals in a seemingly impenetrable fortress can keep death at a distance. What hope do the rest of us have? What hope do we have? We as a society have tried as best we can to keep death at arm's length. We don't like to talk about it. We don't like to think about it. In fact, as we've largely moved away from the farm where we were confronted with it on a regular basis, we now have sanitized it. Most people go off to those clean, sterile environments we call hospitals to die. In fact, my guess is many of us may never even have seen someone die. The older I get, the more I realize that death is a reality we all face. When I moved to Victor, I was very much enjoyed funerals because I was given the privilege of encouraging others. I was the helpful, comforting third party. But as I've been here for nearly 17 years, most of the funerals I now perform are not acquaintances. They're not church members. They're friends. I'm no longer comforting the grieving. I'm part of the grieving. But it's not just something for someone else. As I'm getting older, death seems to be visiting far more often. It was just 2 years ago this May that my wife received a phone call that her father was backing his Caterpillar D9 onto the trailer like he had done hundreds of times. But this time it fell off and rolled over top of him and he was gone. I'm reminded every time I go up to the Twin Cities to see my parents, as I watch their bodies begin to fail, that I know it probably won't be long until I'll get that phone call. But it's me, too. I'm no longer spring chicken. My body doesn't respond like it once did. I have aches and pains I don't remember having. They come from nowhere and don't seem to go away quite as quickly as I wish they had. And I am reminded, my time on earth won't be that much longer. Charles Spurgeon is a pastor who was called the Prince of Preachers back in the 1800s in London. And I think he captured well our idea of death. He says, yes, we admit that we shall die, but not so soon as to make it a pressing matter. We imagine that we are not within measurable death of the tomb. Even the oldest man gives himself a little longer lease on life. And when he's past his 80 years, we have seen him hugging life with as much tenacity as if he had just commenced it. My guess is right about now some of you are thinking, doesn't he know it's Easter? This is supposed to be an encouraging message. I am convinced until we understand death, we will never understand the resurrection. As I was thinking about where to go this Easter, the Easter story is found in all four of the Gospels, and we could very easily go to any of the four Gospels and explore the story, but I was struck this year by the way Paul describes it. Paul writes to the church at Corinth, and Corinth is a city that most of us could relate to. It was in a world that was largely struck by poverty, and yet Corinth was a city of great wealth. Its main goal in life was to find entertainment, enjoyment. They were seeking the next fun thing to do. They were filled with all of the pleasures this world could bring. Those struggles for pleasure entered the church. In fact, the book of 1 Corinthians is really a dissertation of all of the problems that had seeped into the church. But Paul begins in chapter 1 looking at the factions as groups say, no, you can't do it their way, you need to do it my way. He moves on, and in chapter 5 there's some incredible sexual perversion in the church. He comes to chapter 6 and people are suing each other. Lawyers are prominent in the church, suing for a few dollars. He comes to chapter 7 and struggles with the whole subject of divorce and remarriage and how does that affect the church. He continues, and in chapter 11 he comes to the most important ceremony in the church, the Lord's Supper. And rather than being an opportunity to remember Jesus' death, it was an opportunity to get together and get drunk and have a drunken feast. But as he's finishing up his book, he comes to the problem that every single one of us will face: death. How do we live knowing that death will find us? Well, Paul, in 1 Corinthians 15, we could take the time to read the entire chapter this morning. In fact, it would be worth our time to take hours looking at it. But I just really wanted to center in on just one part of the story. Beginning in verse number 20, after he's laid out the historical proof of the resurrection, the misconception that was being taught in there, and then he'll conclude with how the resurrection shows us what will become of us and how it ultimately gives us great victory. He turns in verse 20 and he says, "But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead. He is the first of a great harvest for all who have died. You see, just as death came into the world through a man, now the resurrection from the dead has begun through another man. Just as everyone dies because we all belong to Adam, everyone who belongs to Christ will be given new life. But there is an order to this resurrection. Christ was raised as the first of the harvest. Then all who belong to Christ will be raised when he comes back." I really want to just look at two verses this morning. And really, I only want to look at two stories. I don't have a fancy outline for you this morning. In fact, I didn't even put one in the bulletin, because I just want to look at two stories. Because I think in order to understand Christ's resurrection, we need to understand the reality of death. He begins by saying, "Death came because of one man." For those of you who are coming regularly, you realize that this year we're going through the book of Genesis. Genesis is becoming fast one of my favorite books, as we've had a chance to go through a number of these stories. But January, February, and March, we spent the first 3 months in the first 11 chapters. And in those chapters, Moses shares with us the beginnings of everything. He shows the beginning of marriage, the beginning of languages, the beginning of so many things. But in chapter 1, he begins with God. And then almost in a bullet point fashion, he shares with us how everything came to be. He says God spoke, and on day 1, light separated itself from darkness. And day 2, the water separated itself and we had land. On day 3, he filled the land with plants. On day 4, he filled the sky with stars, moons, and many stars and the sun. On day 5, he filled the water with fish and the air with birds. On day 6, he planted the land with animals. And then he slows a bit, and he turns his attention to God's greatest creation, the only creature in all the universe made in His image. He comes to the chapter 2 and he spends more time how that God spoke and everything came to be, but not with man. With man, he carefully took and reached into the dirt and he formed man to look just like he wanted him to. And then he reached down and he breathed into man the breath of life. It wasn't long until he realized Adam was alone, or I should say Adam realized he was alone, and God said, you need a helper, someone to complete you. And he takes a rib and he makes Eve and he puts them together in this incredible union we call marriage. And they were placed in a garden, a place without pain, without sorrow, without suffering, and with no hint whatsoever of death. And God says, it's all yours. Enjoy it all. Have dominion over it. Rule, reign, fill the world with your children. Enjoy it. But I do have one prohibition. There's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You may not eat of that tree. Adam and Eve enjoyed the garden. They enjoyed in the cool of the evening, God himself would come and they would have these long, drawn-out conversations as they intimately and continually fellowshiped with God himself. And then in chapter 3, we're introduced to a serpent. John, in his final book, the book of Revelation, will tell us that this was not just any serpent. It was Satan himself. And he comes to Eve. And even though we're thousands of years away from Adam and Eve, Satan really hasn't changed his approach very much. He comes to Eve and he begins to get her to doubt that God is really interested in her good. God doesn't really want the best for you, Eve. I mean, after all, why did he put this rule out there? Everyone knows that rules by their nature are bad. I mean, be honest, if somebody at work tomorrow tells you that they had a great weekend, was your idea, oh, they went to church, they followed all of the rules, and they had a great time. Is that what comes to mind? No. We all know that rules are for our restriction. It's because somebody doesn't trust us. It's because somebody doesn't really like us. They're not really interested in what's best for us. They have to put these here for their benefit, not ours. And Satan begins Eve thinking, God isn't really interested in your good. After all, what about that tree? Didn't he say you couldn't eat of any tree in the garden? And Eve says, no, that's not true. He said we couldn't eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. In fact, we couldn't even touch it. God hadn't said she couldn't touch it. But as the serpent begins to maximize the restrictions and minimize the blessings, Eve begins to doubt. And then Satan goes to his second step. He lies about God's promises. I know God said you're going to die, but he's lying to you. You can't really believe God. He's just all in it for himself. He doesn't care about you at all. You will not surely die. And Eve looks at the fruit, realizes it looks inviting, and she takes the fruit and she eats it. She hands it to Adam, and he bites, and suddenly all humanity has changed, because death did come. Death is not simply the end of a physical life, it's a separation from anything, and suddenly the friend who was God becomes a feared foe. In fact, when God comes in the cool of the evening to have the fellowship like he had done, they run from him, they're scared to death of him, because now God is not a friend, he's somebody to be feared. But death did come. In fact, chapter 4, we suddenly are introduced to violence. The first child in the history of humanity, the very firstborn son, Cain, becomes angry at God and takes his anger out on God, on his brother, and murders his brother. And death visits earth. In fact, as you go to chapter 10, Moses begins to share with us what are often called genealogies, this list of so-and-so had so-and-so, but at the end of every single person, you read the words, and he died. Adam lived 930 years, and he died. And he died. And he died. And he died. Every person, no matter how good they were. We're in Abraham's life right now. Abraham is called a friend of God. Abraham is called the father of faith. Abraham is an amazing individual, and yet Abraham died. Moses, who's writing the story of Genesis, was a man who did amazing miracles. He parted a Red Sea. He brought water from a rock. He did a number of miracles, and yet Moses died. David, a person we studied last fall, an amazing individual, somebody who is said to be a man after God's own heart, slew a giant, was the greatest king Israel would ever have, and yet David died. We come to the New Testament and we're introduced to these apostles who do amazing miracles. And yet every single one of them died. Paul in Romans chapter 6 will tell us that the reason they died is because wages of sin are death. What you and I deserve because we have sinned. And I'm afraid sometimes we misunderstand sin. I think if we're honest, we generally think of sin as the bad things other people do. But as you study through the scripture, sin is any thought or deed in which I violate the will of God, or I fail to do it for the glory of God, and I fail to do it through the power of God. If I, for once, do something for my own glory, I've sinned. If I fail to do something for God's glory, I've sinned. None of us can even come close to that standard, and thus we all deserve death. And you will die. The Bible nowhere promises us freedom from death, but it does promise us victory over death. In fact, as you come back to the story, he says that it is true that everyone dies. Why? Because we all belong to Adam. We all come from Adam. Every single one of us in this room are a descendant of Adam. But there was another man, another Adam, who came and lived a perfect life. His name, of course, was Jesus. And if we had time this morning, we certainly don't have time, we could go back and we could follow him from his birth all the way through his life as he begins to do the will of the Father through the power of the Father, always for the glory of the Father. But then the unthinkable happens. Jesus dies. In Luke chapter 24, there's this incredible story of these two individuals. I love this story because sometimes it's difficult to really imagine myself as Peter. Difficult to understand how I could be one of the disciples, how I could be Paul. But Luke chooses to share a story of two individuals, Mr. and Mrs. Nobody, if you will. We don't know for sure it's Mrs. Nobody, but many scholars would suggest because Cleopas' name is shared, and we don't know who Cleopas was, and we're simply told a second, many have concluded it was Mrs. Cleopas. It was his wife. These are two individuals that the Bible shares nothing about, but we know that they were ones who had watched. They had watched as this unknown carpenter's son from Galilee, not even from prestigious Jerusalem, from Galilee, began to teach. He didn't teach like other people. He didn't speak the way others spoke. His teaching had authority. But it wasn't just his teaching that amazed people. It was his activity. He began to heal people. In fact, he made the lame to walk. He made the blind to see, the deaf to hear. People who had leprosy, the hated disease, would come and would be healed. But even more than sickness, he had the power over death. Just a few weeks before Jesus would come to Jerusalem, he would go to the city of Bethany. In Bethany were some of his best friends. We read about him on a couple occasions going to the house of Mary and Martha and Lazarus. And Mary and Martha send word to Jesus, "Your good friend Lazarus is sick. Please come quickly. The doctors can't help him." But Jesus says, "No, I'm not going to go." And Lazarus dies. Finally, after 4 days, Jesus comes to the house of Mary and Martha, and before he even gets there, Martha hears that Jesus is coming, and Martha rushes out, and as soon as she sees him, she says, "Why didn't you come? You know my brother would have lived. Have you not come?" He goes into the house, and he sees Mary, and in the shortest verse in the English Bible, Jesus weeps. He sees the agony that death has brought, and he asks to go to the tomb. And as he goes to the tomb, he gives the unthinkable command, "Open the tomb." And Martha says, "No, no, Jesus, he stinks. He's been dead 4 days. He's starting to rot." But they do it anyway. And Jesus simply says, "Lazarus, come forth." And from death, comes Lazarus. It's no wonder that as Jesus arrives for the Passover feast, the people gather as he's coming and they begin to wave palm branches, the national symbol of Judaism. They're saying, he is the one who's going to set us free from the Romans. He's come to throw off the Romans. I mean, after all, how can anyone defeat somebody that can raise any troops that die from the dead? No one stands a chance. This is our king. Then he goes in and he goes into the temple and he goes and he throws out those money-grubbing religious leaders and he throws them out of the temple and he sets up a shop there for several days and he embarrasses them as they come to try and embarrass him. And then he leaves. Well, maybe he's just wanting to have dinner with his disciples. After all, it is the Passover feast. He's probably waiting till Passover is over. Then he'll throw off the bondage of the Romans. But one of his most trusted friends, the one who kept the money, with a kiss betrays him. And they watch as Jesus is taken and brought before a kangaroo court in the middle of the night, which was against the Jewish law, and is found guilty of blasphemy, sentenced to death, and they take him to Pilate, the Roman official, because the Jews didn't have authority to kill someone, and he laughs at them. You're just jealous of him. But just for the sake of keeping peace, he has Jesus torturously beaten, and I can't even begin to describe the agony it would have involved, but that wasn't enough. They demanded he die. Pilate didn't care about any of the Jews. He just wanted peace. And so he allowed them to take Jesus and humiliatingly drag him through the middle of town. The Roman soldiers had fixed a crown, not of jewels, but of thorns, and smash it into his head and spit on him and mock him and make fun of him. And eventually they take him out, and in the most torturous manner possible, they crucify him. And Cleopas and his friend watch from a distance as Jesus is taken down from the cross, wrapped in 100 pounds of spices, placed in a tomb, and all their world has collapsed because everything they had hoped for was gone, and all they could think about was death. They couldn't go home on Saturday. It was the Sabbath, and the Sabbath was a ritual day and a holy day. You weren't allowed to walk 7 miles on the Sabbath, so they stay over another day. But finally, as Sunday morning comes, they begin the long journey. And these followers of Jesus were walking to the village of Emmaus, which is 7 miles from Jerusalem. And as they walked along, they were talking about everything that had happened. And as they talked and discussed things, Jesus himself suddenly came and began walking with them. But God kept them from recognizing him. And he asks them, what are you discussing so intently as you walk? I've often wondered. I'm afraid had I been Cleopas or the other gentleman, I might have said to Jesus, would you just leave me alone and get out of here? Can't you see that I'm hurting? I don't even know you. You are a perfect stranger. I don't want to answer your questions. I don't want to be interrogated by you. Just go. They say, then the one named Cleopas replied, you must be the only person in all of Jerusalem who hasn't heard about all the things that have happened there the last few days. Oh, really? What things? Jesus asks them. The things that happened to Jesus, the man from Nazareth, they said. He was a prophet who did powerful miracles. He was a mighty teacher in the eyes of God and all the people. But our leading priests and other religious leaders handed him over to be condemned to death, and they crucified him. We had hoped he was the Messiah who had come to rescue Israel. This all happened 3 days ago. And then this morning, some women from our group of his followers were at the tomb early this morning, and they came back with an amazing report. They said his body was missing, and that they had seen angels who told them Jesus is alive, and some of our men ran out to see, and sure enough, his body was gone. Just as the women had said. And then Jesus said to them, you foolish people. You find it so hard to believe all that the prophets wrote in the scriptures. See, the disciples were much like us. They heard what they wanted to. They had read the Old Testament. In fact, they had studied the Old Testament. And as they studied it, they saw Messiah who would reign and rule, who would set off the bondage of all of their enemies and establish in Jerusalem a kingdom that would rule the world. They didn't understand this Psalm 22, where Messiah would have to suffer. Or Isaiah 53, that he would be beaten beyond recognition, even as a human being. That didn't fit into their theory, their ideas, their understanding of who Messiah was. And so they just simply looked over it. Don't we do that? Oh, I know Easter's about resurrection, and in order to rise from the dead, you have to die. But don't go there. Let's just talk about the good things. But Jesus says, no, wasn't it clearly predicted that Messiah would have to suffer all these things before entering his glory? Then Jesus took them through the writings of Moses and all the prophets, explaining from all the scriptures the things concerning himself. And Jesus talks to them and he shares how it was absolutely necessary. See, you don't understand, the whole reason for the sacrificial system is that you have offended a holy God, and the holy God is mad at you, and his wrath demands that you be punished. And thus he established this system in which there were sacrifices. These innocent lamb, these innocent sheep and ox were brought, and their throats were slit, and their blood would cover your sin. That whole system was to help us understand that God requires a payment for your sin. And then I came, and I lived a perfect life. And then I went to the cross as your lamb to pay the penalty that you deserve. I suffered for you. They listened as Jesus talked. They came to Emmaus and they said, this is our house. And Jesus seemed like he was going to go on, and they encouraged him, you know, it's not safe to walk after dark. Why don't you come in? I'm sure you must be hungry. And he comes in with them. And as he sits down to the meal, he blesses it, and the moment he breaks bread, I don't know if they finally got a glimpse of his hands and saw the nail prints in his hands. I don't know if it was a reminder of the Last Supper and the way he broke the bread. I don't know exactly what it was, but suddenly their eyes were opened, and they understood that not only did Jesus die for them, but he gloriously rose from the dead so that they can have victory over sin, and that his sacrifice satisfied a holy God on their behalf. Paul says that while we must all die, everyone who belongs to Christ will be given new life. The question is, do we belong to Christ? He begins the chapter back in verse number 2 saying, it is good news that saves you if you continue to believe the message I told you. The gospel is simply that Jesus died according to the scriptures, and 3 days later rose from the dead as a demonstration that God was satisfied with his payment for your sins. As we close this morning, I just want to ask you 2 questions. Are you convinced God has forgiven your sins? Are you convinced that the sacrifice that Jesus offered was sufficient to pay the penalty you deserved? Or are you wondering that maybe you need to add just a little bit to it? I mean, obviously Jesus' sacrifice was great and it was wonderful and it was incredible, but I think in order for God to really forgive me, I have to do something. I have to come to church. I have to participate in communion. I have to get baptized. I have to fill in the blank here. I have to add just a little bit, not a lot, but just a little bit. The minute we begin to add, the payment is rendered unavailable. See, Jesus paid it all, or he paid none of it. He did everything that was necessary. In fact, his resurrection is a demonstration that God accepted the sacrifice, and all he asks is for us to receive it. Have you received it this morning? The second question is, how grateful are you? as you come to the book of Revelation, there is this amazing scene into the very throne room of heaven in chapter 5 in which all of the saints are gathered and they are singing a single song. Worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive glory and honor and power. Why? Because his sacrifice was enough. I am convinced a billion, trillion years from now, you and I will not have even begun to understand the magnitude of his gift. We will for all eternity be consumed with gratitude. My question this morning is, has it begun today? Or will we leave in a few minutes and go eat your Easter dinners and enjoy your Easter gatherings of family and not give another thought to the incredible gift we celebrate this morning? We are here for a single reason, because Jesus died, he was buried, and he rose again. And so right now, I am forgiven, not because I deserve it or earned it, but because Jesus did it all. I hope this Easter we will be consumed with gratitude because of what he did. Father, we bow in your presence this morning, and we simply cannot strongly enough, loudly enough, long enough praise you for your amazing gift. Father, I do ask this morning that any that are here that aren't 100% convinced your sacrifice was enough for them, that this morning they would turn from their sins and simply receive the incredible gift you offer. Not because of their goodness, but because of your amazing grace. And Father, as we who have received the gift, I pray that we might be a people filled with praises, for you are so awesome. Thank you for all that you are and all that you have done, for it is in your holy and precious name we pray.